This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
Now we move on to the last film, The Thunderdome, which Jill, my wife Jill, she pokes fun at me because I can't ever say Thunderdome without trying to sound like Tina Turner because...
Mark, can't we just get beyond Thunderdome? I had to say it.
You did.
Mystery now, Science Theater 3000 fans know I had to say it.
Of course you had to say it. Thunderdome. Okay, so we have Thunderdome, which... the third one in the trilogy, and probably the most Hollywood of the films, maybe, out of all of them. Now, George Miller was involved in this one, but from what I've read up on, because I did want to do a little bit of more reading on it, his friend and producer that worked with him on the first two ended up dying just before this film, during pre-production, didn't he? In a helicopter accident. So George Miller really was only involved in this as far as the action scenes go, and everything else in the film he left to George Ogilvy.
I always wondered why that was the case. I didn't know.
Yeah, I read that, I believe it's trivia even on IMDb, that, yeah, his producer or his friend ended up dying in an accident just during pre-production. And so
Byron Kennedy, according to the IMDb.
Yep. And George kind of took a step back from the project and let him, let George handle everything else except a couple of the action scenes, which you can kind of tell because this does have a bit of a different feel to it from the first two, for sure. First off, we've got a bigger budget, a bigger crew, but this takes an odd turn to where we're going to start off right away. It opens with a film, and we see a character that we saw in the first one. Well, not a character, an actor, Bruce Spence, but he plays a completely different character, or at least a character that doesn't know Mel Gibson.
Yeah, I'd say it's not completely different because they're almost identical characters.
They are.
In a lot of ways, where it's like, you know, it's like if you, I was just reading something online where it's like someone said if you sat them down and had the two characters talk to each other, it'd be General Captain and General Dye going, he goes, well, I like to hide and then steal people's stuff when they're not looking. Hey, I do that too. I like to say something funny when I steal people's stuff. I do that too. I like to fly things. Hey, so do I. I mean, there's so much identical between them, but George Miller himself has said they are different people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a mistake. I actually really like this movie a lot, but that's – I was right with Cole here. The first time I saw this movie, I'm like, first time you see him, of course, because you see – the first thing you see is you see the plane knocking Max down, who's now like this raggedy man. He's walking through the desert. The sands have like swept over the roads and stuff, so he's just got like a camel or something.
Yeah,
and
in a wagon.
And you see, he's flying. He's in a plane, and he knocks these guys over. It's like, oh my god, like, dude, why is Gyro Captain being such a dick? Is it because he's got a kid now and he feels like I should be a dick for my kid? That's not a nice thing for a dad to do. And, yeah, I thought honestly, it took me. I don't even know if I got it the first time I saw it. Remember, I saw this movie when I was like 10 years old when it came out. I don't even know if I got it the first time I saw it, but it's like, oh, they are different people. That was, you know, and they recast certain characters. As we mentioned, one of the guys from Mad Max is going to show up in Fury Road as a different character, we think.
Yeah. Not sure.
And stuff, but...
That threw me off.
But the characters were so similar.
Yeah.
That they, it's like, you know, I get you like Bruce Spence. And, you know, I've seen lots of sequels where the same actor shows up in a different role. But the characters were so similar, like, they should have put Bruce Spence in a different part.
Yeah.
And put somebody else in the fire. It's one of the few mistakes I think the film makes.
Yeah. And for those of you not familiar with Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, we follow Mad Max now. We catch him. He's pretty much a nomad, but he ends up coming across a barter town. And it's a desert town where they've got the Thunderdome where disputes are handled. And when he's banished from a barter town, he ends up meeting up with a tribe of children. And he ends up setting out to trying to save save the children of the apocalypse, which has been established now of why things are the way they are. The first thing that threw me off to at the beginning was having the same character. And it sounds like the rest of you, Glenn, what about you? Did that throw you off?
Oh, absolutely. When I first saw it, I'm like, oh, hey, it's the general captain again.
And he's being a dick. What the hell?
A dick. I'm like, I mean, really? You don't recognize the guy? I mean, come on, man. I mean, yeah, his hair's longer. But,
and he's got a second stripe now.
Yeah, he does have the second stripe. But.
Did you notice that he has the second white stripe now?
Yep.
In the film, and I was like, that can't be coincidence.
I wonder how he's going to have in Fury Road. Is he going to have an even three? Or like?
Well, according to the one poster I saw, it looks like he shaved his head, so he took care of that whole white streak problem. Mm. But we have our hero Mad Max getting to Barter Town, and wow, Barter Town, you can tell civilization's really taken a dive since the first and even the second one. What'd you guys think of Barter Town and how the characters that they had in it? Now, I mean, here this film came out in 85, and we've had our ripoff films before. It almost felt like they were pulling from some of those ripoff films, didn't it?
Certainly in the sense that water is now the scarce item instead of gasoline, because in a lot of those Italian ripoff films, like, say, like Exterminators of the Year 3000, which is one of my favorites, is water is the thing that they're all searching for. I'm like, oh, they're searching for water in this one, too. Okay, I guess it makes sense, but yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. Barter Town is just a great thing, though, because it's, okay, it's the last civilization, but it's almost like it does have a civilization to it. It does have a system of government to it, which, like all other systems of government, again, I get like this, I'm sorry, this is the way the films are made up, guys, which, like all other systems, are made up of people who have to work in the filth and the shit all day long.
literally the shit, because the town is run on pig shit.
Yeah. Methane cometh from pig shit, yes.
Which, I got to admit, I liked that. Did you like that part, Glenn, to where we've abandoned gas now, the fuel, and we've gone to methane, pig shit?
Well, I don't think they have abandoned it. It's the fact that you can't get gas.
Or you can't get it, right?
Can't drill. Yeah.
But, I mean, and then the whole concept of Barter Town, I mean, trying to remember, who run Barter Town?
Masta Blasta.
The Masta Blasta.
No, yeah, I mean, and again, that's showing ingenuity, cleverness.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go to the Exxon, you know, down the street, or, the Clark, or let me pick it, I guess it still exists, the Speedway down the street and get some gas. So what do? I mean, you still want to power stuff. You want to have electricity, you want to, do all this stuff that you want to do. You want to power your vehicles. Well, how do you do if you don't have gas? You make a different type of fuel.
Right. And that they did with Master Blaster, who ended up being the model of any video game villain from then on out. Major boss with the little guy on the back of a big guy.
That doesn't pop up in Borderlands at all.
No.
Of course, it does beg the question of that, as we pointed out, they're searching for water. Those pigs got to drink a lot of fucking water.
They fed them human blood.
You still need water, man.
That's true. Cole, what'd you think of Barter Town that we run into and how they had things set up there?
Oh man, it was beautifully filmed. Really gorgeous long shots and some great performances.
A whole lot of different characters too that we see that don't even get full focus. It kind of had that Mos Eisley feel to it, didn't it?
Yeah, man. No, I love Bartertown as a character. I think it's great, man.
And here we get to another part outside of Pence being a completely different person. We have Tina Turner in here for some reason.
No, I'm going to disagree with you on that. Well, she's great in this movie.
Okay. Go ahead, Scott.
No, I was going to let you have your say.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Make your case.
I had to say, this is a wonderful character. Anti-Entity is a wonderful character because of how she describes of where she came from. You got to wonder who this person was. I mean, maybe she was like somebody who was like working in some like dive restaurant, or maybe it was worse. Maybe she was like some hooker on the street. They basically leave the impression that she was at best a nobody and at worst worse than a nobody. And she until the day after, I was the one left alive, and she built this place up, and she has become kind of the figurehead of this place and rules it as best she knows how, as ferociously and with an iron fist as she can, completely with this iron fist, all the while knowing and resenting that she's not the real person in charge. She's still not in charge. Sure. She's still got people that can order her around, and she's so pissed off about that. Tina, I don't think she did any acting roles after this. Of course, she had done like Tommy beforehand and stuff, which is not really an acting role. It was more of a performance.
I was going to say, I didn't have problems with her character. It was just the casting. I thought
she was good. I thought she was good. This is somebody, you know, I think she could... I always assumed that she drew upon that. I mean, let's face it. This is like when shortly after she had her big comeback in the 80s, where she was basically – she was nothing after she left Ike. You know, after she left Ike Turner, she's done. Then she's like, come on. She came back from one of the most publicly abusive relationships in history, and now we have this character who came from back from nothing and started
– Sure,
sure. I knew she drew on that. I think she did a great job. And what's the only thing that gets her to where you're like, she's not a villain, where she's not a complete villain? It's when she sees the children.
Yeah.
What do you think she lost? What do you think she never got a chance to have that she wanted? Oh, yeah. I love this character, and I love the way she does it. It's... Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome is a great movie. I still think it's a fantastic movie. It's, of course, the most problematic of the series. People get on my case for this too. I always say, one of my favorite parts of the movie is Tina Turner. She's great in this movie, and I love the character that George Miller wrote for her, and I love the character that she portrays.
Oh, Glenn, what about you? I mean, you like the character. Do you think Tina Turner was a decent pick for it? I know I'm probably going to be the minority in this, so go ahead.
No, I think she did a fine job. The problem is I think it's Tina Turner as a person, I think, is almost too iconic to be interpreted as anyone other than Tina Turner.
Yeah.
And... I think she did a fine job. It's the fact that I can't watch this movie and not remove the fact that it's Tina Turner.
Right. And see, and that's my thing.
That's all it is. That's Tina Turner. I know Max is Mel Gibson. But when I watch the movie, that's Max.
Right.
That's not Mel Gibson, that's Max. This is that's Tina Turner.
Yeah.
I can see that. I can see that. I do see somebody else, but I can totally, but I can see how that would be a problem. See, like, just like whenever, like, say, like John Lennon made one of his very few film appearances, or Bob Dylan was in the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Or Kevin Costner in absolutely anything he does.
Yeah, Kevin Costner, anything he does, Kevin Costner. Yeah, I think that's what it is for me. She was such a, at that time, she was such an icon to begin with, to see her, and she was such. Her performance and everything, the Tina Turner, you know, we saw the performer outside of Thunderdome was so iconic to begin with that seeing her as anything else, that's, you nailed it, Glenn, for me. That was the issue I had, was that I didn't see her anything but Tina Turner. What about you, Cole? Tina Turner, decent, I mean, the character was great, don't get me wrong, and she did play it well, but did you see her as anything other than Tina Turner?
Man, you got me cornered. It's hard to offer a decent criticism, you know?
Right. No,
I would say, I mean, when did this come out? 1986?
85, yeah. July 10th, 1985.
Yeah, so I was 6, 7 years old.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's pretty extreme, but... Yeah. On the other hand, this is the first Mad Max movie that's financed via American, right?
Right, which is explains probably why the casting was there.
In fact, I believe Maurice Jarre, who replaced the brilliant Brian May, had an original score composed for those opening credits, which now... are a pretty cheesy song. I mean, to criticize Tina Turner's involvement is pretty extensive, you know. But fucking A, it's a great film.
Like you said, I had no problems with her in the film. I just had a problem seeing her other than Tina Turner in it.
I'm sure it was stunt casting. I mean, and bringing up the music is a wonderful thing because it has you know, One of the Living and Beyond Thunder and We Don't Need Another Hero in the end credits, which is a great song, but still, you know, none of the other movies had pop songs.
What would it be without her, I guess, is, you know.
I mean, I can see them casting somebody else's stuff. I'm sure it was stunt casting. I like what she brought to the performance, though, because I love the character, and I thought that she – I always felt that she brought a lot of her own self to the part, and that's why I liked it. But, I mean, I can see both sides of it, and I've had this argument with people before, you know, because, I mean, there have been times when I've been, like, the only one, like, man, Tina Turner was rock. Awesome. Like, what? Fuck you. They want to, like, throw beer bottles at me at that point.
I'm not saying she was, like I said, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying she was bad in the film at all. I think just the casting of her for me took it out of it because I saw her. I imagined that she was a pop star. This is Tina Turner. She survived. And she became the leader of Thunderdome. You know, I guess I had a little problems with the character because she did seem like she wove a lot of, at least some of herself into that character. And again, I also felt like it was stunt casting, which I sometimes have an issue with, that someone's cast in a role just because they're, at that time, a bigger person or on their way up. You know, whether or not they were actually meant to be in that role. So our Thunderdome itself, now, it's an interesting thing because we've got our Mad Max character who ends up meeting up with Auntie Entity, who is playing him and has him, oh, yeah, you want to take out the Master Blaster, which to this day I can't get over that name. But, of course, we had Humongous and Toe Cutter previously. So and Master is the midget, and Blaster is the big, huge guy that Master rides. And so Mel Gibson eventually gets him into the Thunderdome by challenging him because they took his car, which was pulled by camels. What about that fight scene within the Thunderdome? I thought that was pretty wild, and it felt at the time a bit original. Was that original at all in how they resolved their issues? Glenn, what'd you think of that Thunderdome battle?
Oh, absolutely. I love the Thunderdome stuff, and and it harkens back. I mean, it's like, I mean, it keeps the masses pacified. Mm-hmm. It's like the gladiatorial combat, you know, in ancient Rome. You know, the people don't have TV to watch. You know, they probably, those who can even read books, you know, probably don't have books to read.
Right.
So you need something. One, it solves a problem. You have people have a dispute. Here's a problem to solve it. Two, it gives the people something to watch, as well as a bit of a discouragement from engaging in specific types of behavior. Especially, you know, now you know, well, okay, I'm not going to, you know, really do a lot of crazy shit against the people who run this place, because you're going to fight against, you know, little, you know, sassy chip on a shoulder short guy there who can live through anything.
Yeah.
Or you're gonna fight the giant, mentally disabled. Well, you don't know he's mentally disabled. So just the giant guy in the huge helmet. You know, it's like your options there are not very good for going up against the system.
Right.
And then it comes down to the, you know, if I'm going to do something, one, could I get away with it? Two, could I kill the person I'm doing it to if I get caught?
Right.
And it's you know, so it serves a lot of purposes, and it fits with you know, this society, I think, and it fits in the theme of the film.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the way that Thunderdome battle, the way it was handled, and the idea of Thunderdome, Cole?
Amazing. I love that sequence, man. I mean, you finish off the first third of the film with the best action sequence.
Yeah, right?
I haven't done much research, obviously, for reasons I've listed prior, sure, because I don't want spoilers, but shit, man. I imagine there was a certain backlash because there wasn't, you know, as much car action in this film. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah,
I don't know.
There is a lacking.
There weren't as many cars.
No.
Yeah. And I like that about this film, man. I really do. I like that you almost get the impression when he gets behind the wheel at the end of the very third act, like, oh shit, there's going to be some damage, and it's not that at all. He jumps off the car as quick as like he got on it. I don't know. I just like this film for its structure, mm-hmm, mainly.
Yeah, it is definitely a different it is a departure from the other two of what we had seen.
Yeah.
You know, it is. Now, I want to get to, I know it's getting late, but I want to get to a few other points with this film. One of them is, now we have a reason, because after he's banished, which is just a wild thing dealing with the Wheel of Fate, which I thought was just another level to this society that they had. He gets banished, and he finds this tribe of kids who were not quite sure how they all came together. They've either been banished or were drifting or lost. And they get the whole painting of the caves, and they got their own language, and we've come to find out there were nukes. Mm-hmm. And for me, I guess I had a problem with that, because I was – the other two films, I never got the impression there were nukes. And in here – we've got radiation. I mean, we got an earlier scene where he's testing water to make sure it's not radioactive. Was it intended all along, did you feel? I mean, like I said, I read that George Miller initially intended it for just be the downfall of civilization, but did that take a little bit away and felt a little cliche, the fact that it was nukes, apparently, that eventually brought us to where everybody was in the world, Cole?
Yeah, I think that was much different, and it certainly comes out of left field. But honestly, Mark, like, the one trailer I've seen for the fourth film has water shortage fears, right? Mm-hmm. Right? So, I don't know. I think maybe they're just making minor adjustments from generation to generation. Is that too generous? I don't know. I kind of feel that way about it.
I mean, because we are talking 1985 now, so we've had the nuclear apocalypse film before.
Yeah, but you know what? The whole nuclear apocalypse thing, I mean, they don't even call it an apocalypse. It's, you know.
Poxeclipse.
And he doesn't even really buy their version of it. In fact, that is a great pivotal moment of this film. I love this point of this film where you get to hear Mad Max actually talk about the apocalypse on some level. Mm-hmm. You know, you actually get him to hear him kind of on some level verbalize, oh, fuck, okay, this is how I feel about it. It's like road rash, okay? You know, there is no future. What we have is right here. That's all wonderful. I think that's great. What was the question? I'm so sorry.
You drifted. No, I guess my question was just that making it a nuclear fallout.
The nuclear thing. Yeah, you're right. It specifies it in a way that was not there. Even in the last film, it wasn't there. On the other hand, oh, man. You know, it's like a generational transition, right? You've got these kids who are sort of passing the story along, and that language is pretty awesome. Yeah. I mean, maybe your enjoyment of the film depends on how much you buy their society, you know, and consequently, you get to see Mel Gibson full-fledgedly punch a young woman in the face and knock her out.
Right?
Which is incredible, considering if you go back, you know, fans of film in general, not Mel Gibson fans, but just fans of film should check out Payback, the cut. They call it the straight-up cut, but it's really just Brian Helgeland's film. And there's an initial scene in there where Mel Gibson shows up and punches a woman straight in the face, which they cut out. I think this is it's a great sort of tale for this.
So
Benedict, who's been stuck on the road, and now he's not on the road anymore. He's sort of robbed of everything, and this character who robbed him is not from the Road Warrior. You guys are saying.
No. It's same actor, different character.
Same actor, different character.
Is that how am I supposed to respond to that as a fan? That's crazy.
It is crazy on that. Did that giving it the nuclear trope, Glenn, take something away? Do you think? Or was it maybe assumed by a lot of people because it was never taught and that was the state of the culture at the time? I mean, many of us kids of the 80s know that nuclear fear. Was that maybe assumed? Was it assumed, do you think?
It's just assumed that, you know, if the world's going to end, it's going to end in, you know, nuclear fire. That's what's going to happen. I mean, there was always the part of me, I remember watching this and going, like, why would anyone fucking nuke Australia? I mean, not saying like Australia's worthless, but I mean, like, you know, it's like, I mean, obviously, like, the U.S. wouldn't, you know. Right. So I mean, like, is Russia just like, well, fuck it, if we're going down, we're just taking everyone apart with us? Because I don't think Australia is nuclear capable.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I'm
not sure either. But that's
the thing. Like these, you know, it's like. Everywhere gets nuked. I'm like, really? Well, you're like, what did Papua New Guinea do? No, like in places like, you know, what's, you know, Madagascar? Or, you know, some of these places, but it's just that was always the thing in the 80s. If the apocalypse was going to happen, you know, well, of course, you can use nuclear war.
Right.
It won't be aliens because we'll have blown ourselves up before the aliens get here. We already know this.
So I guess that took away for me because it had been a trope by 1985 for me. Scott, what about you? I mean, I know you love the film, but did that still seem like an easy explanation?
You know, by that point, and in certain ways, it's one of the things that you have against it because it was such a popular trope that I just didn't really even care that they had done it. first of all, we're already dealing with lots of suspensions of disbelief. You know, what's going to happen when nuclear bombs go off? Does that mean, like, everybody's, like, going to start behaving like a punk rocker and driving around? No, it means we're not going to be here, and the people that are left are probably going to die slowly of radiation poisoning. Glenn brings up an interesting point, is that it could be the nuclear bombs that happened in other nations and just kind of I never even thought about that before he started talking about that. But I didn't mind it because I'd seen it had become a thing. And as I've mentioned, I can't remember what other episode of the show I mentioned it on, but and you talked about it a little bit. Dude, the fear of the inevitability. Mm-hmm. The seeming inevitability that we are going to blow ourselves up with nuclear bombs. It was so all-encompassing that most of us could just thought, is it going to be in my lifetime? It might be. If it happens, it's just a matter of time. You know, so to me, it didn't really matter that it wasn't. Whether it is or it isn't, when I watch this again, I'll have to like keep that in mind. Like think, like, oh, maybe it wasn't really. Who knows? Or because you know we know that that bit was added on in the Road Warrior,
right?
But honestly, I at this point I didn't mind. I mean, the kids are what most people had problems with in the movie.
Well, because I mean, they don't really go into it because the kids don't explain it the best of how they formed their tribe. And if you look at the male to female ratio and who is getting older and younger, it starts to get that little creepy feeling of that whole group going, how long have these kids been out here?
Is that why there's like one guy who can't do anything but like yank on that Bugs Bunny chain? Like,
I mean, I can see why, and that's what I never quite understood the tribe, you know, how they came together. I kind of, after watching it this time around for the episode, I kind of had to piece together that, oh, maybe some of these are people that were drifting and vagabonds and left orphans and such, because I'm like, otherwise, you're really getting into some really weird connotations with this tribe of kids who are talking about Walker and damn kids and their technology, let me tell you. what was interesting about that whole kid tribe thing is, do you think that Tina Turner's group, they didn't know about them out there, did they?
No.
Which makes, you know, makes me wonder, you know, those kids, how did they truly survive? I mean, they had water, but if there's radiation, did you really want to drink it? I mean, there's a lot of questions with that tribe, and I guess that's how did you feel about that kid tribe in general as far as just them being there? You know, that suspension of disbelief, I guess, for me was hard to look past, but it sounds like it is easier for at least Cole and Scott to look past this group, or did there had to have been questions? I
mean, are we talking about like realistic, you know, post-apocalyptic environments?
Well, the film's up to that point, though. I mean, it just is a great departure. You know, it's a huge departure from the setup of the rest of the two films. So,
yeah. Well. I think part of it comes from the fact that you had two directors.
Uh-huh.
Because, I mean, George Miller pretty much, he was only involved in the action scenes.
Right.
And Ogilvy,
yeah, had the rest.
Did everything else. And I think that shows is that you had two different people's visions in this film. And I think that might attribute to some stuff with the kids. Now, as far as it taking me out of... I didn't find it believable. I just didn't like it.
Right.
Because I hate children, and children are... That's not entirely true. I hate children in movies, mostly.
Could you find them annoying, yes.
Yes. God, some kids in some movies. Now, these ones weren't super annoying.
Right.
They're not like the fucking kid in... what is that fucking movie with... I can't remember it now. This horrible movie where this guy's going to become the new Elvis out in
3,000 miles to Graceland, or
no.
Six String Samurai.
That kid and that. Just, that's all he says, like the whole movie, just over and over again. And too many kids in movies are like that. They're either super annoying or they're there solely as some kind of comic relief. Mm-hmm. And I hate that crap. Mm-hmm. The kids in here weren't bad. I mean, I think it's kind of there's some interesting bits to it. As far as them having survived where they are, I attribute that up to the water source that where they are. It's obviously a freshwater spring that comes from water deep underground, which is constantly flowing, which is why that water isn't killing them and turning them into horrible mutants, which would have been even better. Just giant mutants for Max to fight. Captain Walker could have been, some giant robot or something. And then,
I would have loved to see those kids' reaction, or Max's reaction, if he, got woken up by a bunch of mutants.
Well, if he got woken up by some chuds or something. I think maybe it's also they definitely took a much lighter tone with this movie.
Right.
There's so much more comedy in this.
Yeah, there really is, man.
Yeah. I did make a note of that too, that it was a lot lighter than the other one.
Well,
I mean the whole character of Iron Bar.
Yeah.
The little guy, I mean, that's all comedy, and the mechanic guy, all these kids, so many of these characters are comedic. And then you got the kids in here, which gives definitely a softer feel because, the only kid we had in the first one gets run over by motorcycle guys. And the second one, it's a feral kid that throws boomerangs around that chops off people's hands. So definitely they went somewhere much lighter. And I don't know if it's kind of in Road Warrior you get the, at least for some of the people, they get the happy ending. They go off to their, to the bright shining sea and they become the Great Northern Tribe. And this is kind of more of that, there's hope for the future type of thing.
Right.
Because they're still kids and, kids are, our future, if you teach them well, you can let them lead the way. And, I went there. I see that. I mean, there's actually a, I guess, for lack of a better name, a touching scene. Actually, a couple scenes that were cut from the film. One being Max dreaming about his family and crying. And they cut that. We're like, we can't have Max cry. And there's also one where one of the kids, Gecko, he's dying. And Max takes him and shows him the lights of Bartertown. And as Gecko's dying, he says, "There's tomorrow, Marland, you made it."
Oh.
And it shows in that scene, more so than the Max crying one, I think shows the fact that Max is not completely hollowed out inside.
Right. Well, he's kind of trying to bring him back on the road to being human. I'm sorry, Cole, I did cut you off there before. I apologize. Did the kids bring up questions for you, though? I mean, they had to bring up something, didn't they?
Yeah, man. They did, although I get so wrapped up in the story.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about Beyond Thunderdome specifically, I get really wrapped up in that story and the way it's musically told. And one thing I wanted to mention was all these films are kind of musicals, and the first film to a lesser degree, but Road Warrior specifically, is nothing without Brian May's score.
Right.
And Maurice Jarre, and I know I'm not pronouncing that right, my apologies, but
that's how we all pronounce it, no worries.
there is a correct pronunciation for that.
Yeah.
But he did the score for this, and it's equally as good, for sure. But this film is a musical as well. It uses almost vocal tonage and almost vocal elasticity to tell a story right down to the what's the tool they give him where the 3D glasses. I had
the Viewmaster. Yeah.
The Viewmaster.
Yes. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm limiting myself there as a human being, but I was around for that era. All that stuff I think works great. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but Mad Max during the course of the storyline follows these wayward teenagers right to the heart of Bartertown, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he gives them so many second chances.
Yeah, that's
this is a good movie. I really love Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Oh. I probably got lost in my description, but
it's okay.
I enjoy this film quite a bit.
It's okay. It's getting late. I've kept you guys pretty long on this, but
I just wanted to really say though, like that the kids, you know, I think a lot of the people got really mad at the kids in this movie, as well as the idea that the movie was PG-13 instead of R.
Yes.
That was a big deal when it came out. I was freaking out. I was like, oh boy, it's PG-13. I was happy because that meant I could go see it, you know, because I was 10 years old. But, you know, but I know like a lot of people are like, oh man, the hard edge is going to be gone from it. And it kind of is. It's a softer edge. And I think a lot of people rolled their eyes when the kids came out. Because how many films have we seen where kids just ruin the damn movie? Glenn's absolutely right. It's like, so you kind of like, when they come in, you're like, oh, here we go. This one, yeah, there's a few kids where you just want to be like, there's one kid gets swallowed up and you're like, good. but you know, there's some kids who annoy you in this, but really, I like, you look at it as an adult, I like the indigenous society that they created. According to all the trivia, it was originally this wasn't originally a Mad Max film. It was originally about these kids.
Yeah,
they turned it into one.
Because George Miller just dropped in. I guess they had the idea, and George Miller happened to just make an off-the-cuff message of, well, what if it's Max who discovers them? And that's what spawned it to be a Mad Max film, from what I read.
Yeah, and I actually like the kids, you know. There's certainly, I can see where it's kind of a betrayal to some of the people who want a more hard-edged movie. But I think it's also important to show that Max completing that arc. He started this series as a not just a husband, but as a new father.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the kids where, you know, some of these kids might be around the age of that his son might have been.
Yeah, that's true.
And I kind of see it that this is that the series is about Max losing and then regaining his humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you get here. And I think that the kids are kind of essential to that. And you see that paralleled in Auntie as well. When she sees the kids, she's like, oh, shit. I'm bad. I'm not that bad.
Yeah.
So,
then we do get a chase scene at the end with the train, which there's still tracks. Apparently, those don't get covered with sand. And the cow car, which out of all the cars in all of Mad Maxdom, I love the cow racing car.
Did you ever look at that and think, how many cows did they have to stitch together?
Folks, there's a racing car in here that's completely covered in cowhide, run by a guy, no shit, in a cowboy hat. Go figure. And Mad Max uses that car at one point. And so we do get a Mad Maxian chase at the end. And you're right. He does come full circle. And if you really want to get deep, especially as we get that coda at the end, he becomes a dad once again to society, to a new society, by saving the kids who fly away in not the gyro captain's plane. And so we get that scene at the end. And what do you think about how they had Mama, it was almost like the ending of the second one, wasn't it, with the sand? Only this time it was Anti-Entity instead of Max who smiled at what had happened. Did you get that certain similar vibe of the ending to where she let it go because it was like, okay, you got me? Was that a similar feel for you guys?
Yeah, for me it was. I definitely had the kind of feel that this was a that was kind of a nod to the Rogue Warrior.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because she doesn't kill Max at the end. He's wiped out. I mean, he's destroyed her town, and he's wiped out most of her guys and the cow car. Sad tear. The cow car got died, and yet at the end, smiles.
Cow car is hamburger.
she smiles and drives away, similar to the way the end of Road Warrior was. And go ahead, Scott.
I think she sees a kindred spirit there. And he's a survivor. She's going to be fine. When she says, "We will rebuild," I truly believe that. Yeah, sure. She's going to rebuild Bartertown, and she's going to be okay. And I think she sees a kindred spirit there, much like, you know, I was just talking about, you know, Max, like how he would say, like, "Yeah, I'd do that," you know, from Road Warrior, you know, is that. And she even says it well. And a great last line. Again, I love this performance. I don't care what you say. Ain't we a pair, Raggedy Man? I'm like, oh, what a great line. It's like, you know, like, it's like, yeah, okay, I'm going to survive. You're going to survive. Let's just not hang out.
So I think we'll wrap it up here. I've kept you guys really late. Thank you for staying up. I think we all agree that this is definitely an interesting trilogy. I never thought in my day that I would see another Mad Max film coming to the big screen. And I'm just let's just throw out real quick, and then we can pip our stuff. We will be doing a Fury Road show next week. Let's do a little bit of prediction now. I've tried to avoid all the reviews I can with it. What I want out of Fury Road is some badass chase scenes, which it looks like we get, and Mad Max being our quiet hero again, and it looks like we may get that as well. And I just want an entertaining good time that feels a lot like the Road Warrior, which from the trailer it almost feels like it. And that's all I asked for from Fury Road, but I think I'm going to enjoy it. Not sure I get to see it this weekend. Scott, what about you? What do you look for in Fury Road, and do you think you're going to enjoy it?
Not a lot of preconceptions. I would, because I'm not expecting another Mad Max movie like the ones we've had. Mm-hmm. I don't think George Miller is the type of director who goes backwards.
Okay.
I think whatever he has come up with will be some kind of new spin on the material. Again, I've avoided stuff too.
Sure.
As long as it's one of those, it's a film like that, like the others, really makes you feel, gives you that adrenaline rush and emotional rush of being right there in the action, the crazy manicness, like those nutty Australians we know they are. like how you see that, oh, what a lovely day. God. Yeah.
Yeah.
As long as they put us right in there and really make you feel that, no other preconceptions, man. That's all awesome. I want. I want to see. It's been 30 years. I'm so happy he's done another one. I'm not expecting a film that takes me back to when I was 8 or 10. I want to see, where are you taking us next?
Sure.
And that's it.
What about you, Glenn? Any expectations in Fury Road, or you just hope it's an entertaining film?
Well, you know, I'm expecting to go in seeing the apparently full-blown feminist propaganda that is this film by daring to have a strong female character. My expectation is a two-hour car chase. That's my expectation.
Yes.
And I mean, I've read a little bit about some of the stuff that, you know, some criticism some people have had without having seen the movie. I'm like, great. You're okay, and why it's awful. Now, I mean, I can accept criticism of why someone might think a movie will be bad, like, say, it has Keanu Reeves in it. Well, I don't trust him as an actor to be playing, you know, Lord Dumblefart of, Hexington Manor, a British noble. You know, okay, fine. But this, I have high expectations for it. I trust George Miller to do it right. From what I have seen, it looks pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that has me the most psyched is that CG in this film is used to enhance the practical effects, not in place of practical effects.
Part of the reason why it's taken so long to get to screen, from what I understand. So
yes, I mean, and that's me. That's, I mean, some things can only be done with CG.
Right.
But so many things are done with CG they don't need to be. You mm-hmm. don't need to CG cars. We have those already.
Lots of them to spare.
Yes. So that is the thing that has me the most excited. Is that I'm going to see a lot of practical effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has me excited too, the practical effects side of it. When I heard that like 85-90% of the film is practical effects, and if you've seen just one trailer, you're going, holy crap, half most of that's practical? You're kidding me. Oh boy, I'm excited. Cole, what about you? Just any expectations at all for Fury Road or what you'd like to see?
Man, brother, I'm super excited. Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me on the show tonight. My opinion of Fury Road is high. Wait for it to come out. Our good friend Glenn did a review of Guardians of the Galaxy, and I won't recapsulate that word for word here, but his opinion of Guardians of the Galaxy was pretty much my opinion of Road Warrior, which is...
Sure.
Man, if you've got a hard-on that can reach the moon, this is it. I love Glenn for that review. I'll never forget that review. And I feel that way about Road Warrior, man. Road sure. Warrior is, Mark, you're one of the few people who see my movies.
Yeah.
I think Road Warrior is all over Little Riding Hood in a way.
It is. The sense of desolation
and hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all I can say is I'm amped, man. Yeah. I'm amped for George Miller's next project. I'm amped for seeing fucking Tom Hardy as Rokitansky. Mm-hmm. What a great choice. And I'm excited. I don't know what to say. I'm excited.
I'm
not being very professional. I apologize.
No, well, that's not professional. That's just like me. I saw that trailer. First time I saw the Fury Road trailer, I had no more misconceptions or any worries about the film when I saw how they did the trailer, because that trailer was nothing like any other modern movie trailer you see. This is what I look for in this is an action film that isn't like the action films we've had, which have been a lot of comic book based ones. Just looking for something completely out there, original, someone who says, thank you, Mr. Producer, for giving me all this money. I'm going to make the film I want to make. And that's what it feels like. And I know there's some people out there, especially from the younger crowd, who have already seen Fury Road, who didn't care for it. And we may even have a couple of those on our show next week. I look forward to having you guys there as well, talking Fury Road. Real quick, let's just run down quick. Cole, where can they find you at, sir?
We can find me on Facebook. Please stop by if you want to talk movies. Cole Meredith is my name. Horror Roar is my horror tribute page, but Shadows and Lovers Productions is where you can find out about my original projects, of which there are many coming out. But
awesome.
Let's support independent movies, man. Rock it, seriously.
Yes, because Mad Max was actually one of those.
Yes.
Glenn, what about you, sir? Where can they find you at?
You can find me on Facebook, both just as me and also with the B-Movie Bunker. You can find me on YouTube, Naked Hobo Productions, the B-Movie Bunker, and on Twitter, at Naked Hobo, all one word.
Yeah, and finally, Scott, go ahead, sir.
You can find me at Moviocrity.com. That's where all my stuff is. I'm on Twitter as Moviocrity, and I'm on Facebook is Moviocrity and me. And, you know, also you can, if you want to catch up, you can catch my web series Moviocrity on Vimeo. It's on YouTube as well, but not all the episodes are there because YouTube sucks that way. I'm working on more if I could get my damn program to work. So, but I've been trying. So, yeah, but movieocrity.com is the main place.
Awesome. So, folks, we will have this up before we do our Fury Road discussion. Please tune in back when we give you our take. You've heard what we've predicted, and it'll be interesting to see what our take is after we've seen it. Tune in next week. You can find all our stuff on iTunes and Stitcher Smart Radio. Go to specialmarkproductions.com for links to these brilliant and very patient people who have been kind enough to join me tonight to discuss this very interesting trilogy. Look forward to seeing the next one. Go to specialmarkproductions.com for our archived episodes as well as the reviews I do for We Live Film and all that other stuff that I end up doing. So thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you've enjoyed this super long discussion on this trilogy. And remember, with the spoiler room, the conversation is fresh, but those movies, boy, do we spoil them.